Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the escalating violence in Ukraine and speak with the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, Matthew Rajansky, who is an expert on the states of the former Soviet Union, in particular Ukraine. We will discuss the rising death toll and whether or not the targeted sanctions the EU are imposing on the regime's leaders and oligarchs who support Yanukovych will cause some of the oligarchs to switch sides if they want to travel to the West to visit the hordes of cash they have stashed abroad. Then we'll look into the ousting of the head of Nigeria's central bank, who blew the whistle on $20 billion that are missing and cannot be accounted for out of the $67 billion in oil revenues the state-owned Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation received from the sale of oil between January 2012 and July of 2013. The former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria, John Campbell, the author of Nigeria, Dancing on the Brink, joins us to discuss the entrenched high-level corruption inside of the opaque state oil company and how it impacts the largely impoverished 170 million Nigerians already beset by a bloody insurgency that could lead to a civil war between the Christian South and the Muslim North. Then finally, we'll examine the president's decision to drop the chained CPI Social Security cut from his 2015 budget and speak with Eric Kingston, the founding co-director of Social Security Works, which launched and staffs the Strengthened Social Security Coalition that he co-chairs. We will discuss the possibility that Obama may have recognized the futility of trying to reach out to the Republicans and in this election year will show some moral leadership to help elderly, poor, and unemployed Americans who have been sacrificed on the altar of deficit reduction at a time when deficits are falling to record levels. And joining us now is Matthew Rajansky, who is the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, an expert on U.S. relations with the states of the former Soviet Union, especially Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova. He has advised governments, intergovernmental organizations on conflict resolution and efforts to enhance shared security throughout the Euro-Atlantic and Eurasian region. Previously, he was the deputy director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he founded Carnegie's Ukraine program. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Rajansky.
Thanks, Ian. Happy to be with you.
And it seems at this point, with the real bullets being used, there's been some, obviously, the Maidan has become militarized, and the situation at this point, at least the use of firearms, there was some restraint in that regard. Once that really breaks down, you could have a serious conflict, could you not?
Yeah, I think we're at a point where maybe it's not all bets are off and outright war, but it's surprisingly and dangerously close to that. And I think the thing that worries me further is that I don't really see the effectiveness of any of the measures that are being taken or threatened by outsiders. In other words, there don't seem to be levers that we can pull from the outside to de-escalate the situation, and that's very troubling.
Well, wouldn't, though, the sanctions, if they're targeted by the EU against, first of all, apparently the Yanukovych regime is a kleptocratic regime, and the eldest son, the dentist, apparently has been shaking down all of the oligarchs and basically saying, I'm your new 50% partner, and getting most of the government contracts. What if some of these key oligarchs who still support Yanukovych could be peeled off? Would that make some difference if their assets abroad and ability to travel were curtailed? Wouldn't that get their attention?
You're getting right to the heart of the issue. The answer is maybe. We don't know. And that's because it's a very delicate situation when you start to try to apply pressure on these quite powerful, somewhat unpredictable relationships between the oligarchs and the ruling authorities. Remember, you're exactly right. Some of them are alienated now from Yanukovych. Others of them have cut deals. But the question is, what kinds of sanctions can you threaten or impose against them that will not go over the line of hurting ordinary Ukrainians, isolating and alienating Ukrainian society at large? Remember, the vast majority of people are still not out in the streets, and you don't want to put them in a position where they feel that the international community and the West in particular have been callous towards their suffering. But at the same time, you want to act in a way that's likely to de-escalate things. And I worry that with the oligarchs, you may force a couple of outcomes that would be unintended. One, it could become a kind of a litmus test. If you don't fall subject to the sanctions, then the regime will take further steps against you. So you, as a businessman who might otherwise be quite reasonable, ready to talk, you'd sort of clam up and you would adopt a harsher position. And I think second is we really don't know. Some of the oligarchs might cut their own separate deals with the Russians. Some of them may begin to intervene. Remember, these are heavily armed camps, and they may begin to intervene as well in ways that could lead to widening of the violence. So it's starting to play with fire. It goes well beyond the visa bans that have been announced so far.
But my understanding is that one of the things that's propelling the disgust and unrest in the country is this kleptocratic family and their excesses. It's really, in a curious way, it's similar to what started the Arab Spring. The Tunisian people just got disgusted with this the tacky embezzlement of the ruling family.
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of frustration throughout Ukrainian society about that. But on the other hand, what you're seeing today is tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of people who are willing to risk life and limb to make a statement and fight against that corruption that they see. What we have not yet, after 23 years of independence, seen in post-Soviet Ukraine is a willingness on the part of 10 or 20 million people to endure minor discomfort, to cease paying bribes and thus impose rule of law from the bottom up, to stand up when they see businesses being stolen, when they see the shakedown that you talked about. It's not just the president's son. It happens at low levels all the time throughout Ukrainian society, and to defend their own democracy, that is, by voting, by taking elections seriously and not selling their votes as many Ukrainians do. Again, I don't mean to indict all of Ukrainian society here, but there's a very troubling amount of cynicism and passivity among the vast majority of Ukrainians at the same time that you do have a few people or a few thousand people who are willing to take extreme measures.
Again, I'm speaking with Matthew Rudzianski, who is the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, an expert on U.S. relations with the states of the former Soviet Union, especially Russia, Belarus, Moldova, and Ukraine. So if indeed you have a kind of moral rot in the country, and perhaps it is a result of the same kind of moral rot that existed in the Soviet Union that eventually brought it down. But I also understand, at least in the western part of Ukraine, there's always been a distaste for the Soviet Union and a not so much a hatred, but certainly a leeriness, if you will, of Russia. So how do you reconcile those two?
Well, look, I think it's true that there are real differences in attitude and in geopolitical orientation between Western and Eastern Ukraine. But that moral rot that you were talking about, the kind of fundamental unwillingness to endure relatively minor sacrifice but on an ongoing basis in order to do the hard things that are required to build an economy and to build a successful state of governance where the precedent, as you pointed out, is the Soviet precedent, which is a terrible precedent. That's pretty universal across Ukraine. That's Eastern and Western, Central, Southern, and I think the only real difference that I've seen is that there is a younger generation, a fully post-Soviet generation, some of whom have had experience abroad, who are really prepared to do things differently. I mean, I have friends who have tried to open businesses and really refuse to pay bribes, and they've encountered big problems but are nonetheless persisting. I think I would put my hope in that generation. It's not a silver bullet, and it's not going to change overnight, but I would much rather see that kind of bottom-up groundswell transformation than I would see a sort of seizure of power by a Western-oriented group, but through violence, which results inevitably in disappointment, because you know individual political leaders in Ukraine have always ended up disappointing us, whether they're pro-Western or pro-Russian or just pro themselves.
So, but there seems to be an essential problem here, and as much as Putin and the West are talking past each other, Putin clearly sees this as a geopolitical struggle, when it seems pretty clearly to be an internal Ukrainian struggle. Do you think that Putin knows this? I mean, what is he just playing to the gallery? Does he have any concept of how much this is about Ukrainians fighting or at least struggling over two sort of somewhat different models of governance, one, of course, that is the Russian model and the other one that's a European model? At least that seems to be pretty clear that this is internal dissent, not, as far as I know, in spite of the phone call from the State Department official to the U.S. ambassador that the Russians clearly leaked and the presence of EU people. At the end of the day, I don't think the West is not asking Ukraine to join NATO or anything, are they? I mean, this...
No, I think that's right. I think Putin is acutely aware of the reality that Ukrainians are fed up, or that, let's say, those Ukrainians who are protesting are really fed up with the kleptocratic model of post-Soviet governance. But I think he's cynically and smartly using the situation, particularly the situation as it was, you know, a couple months ago before it turned really, really bloody and gruesome, which goes, you know, is way over the Rubicon, I think, for all sides. But when it was just kind of chaos in the streets, disorder, bad for business, essentially, he was able very effectively to make the case to his own population and in particular to his own oligarchs to say, you know, isn't our system better? You know, we may not have this kind of European-style liberal democracy and pluralism, but who needs it if it leads to this chaos? And on the notion that the West is calling the shots and intervening, I mean, it's patently absurd on its face because, of course, if we were, why on earth would we have called the shots to result in shooting? I mean, and similarly, I think for the Russians don't want a bloodbath in this country that's extremely close to them in every way. It really isn't good for business. But that said, you know, the old Soviets saw that the CIA, you know, makes the world go round. This sort of, it's called konspiratsiya in Russian, that everything is a deeper truth, a deeper story beneath what you see. It plays very well. And I think it plays well in Russian-speaking Ukraine, and it plays well in Russia.
So is that to say then, Matthew Rzhensky, that Putin would be happy to see this situation unravel in a kind of way to make a point that this is what you get from Western liberal democracy, just chaos?
No, I don't think he wants to see the situation deteriorate beyond where it is. I think two things have changed dramatically. One is the point's been made, the precedent point about, you know, the instability, similar to the argument Putin made about the Eurozone crisis, that even being a full member of the EU doesn't protect you from, you know, huge double-digit unemployment rates. You know, he's made his point about that. Beyond that, the damage that's being done now to infrastructure and business and confidence and relations with Russia, those are all bad things for Russia. The other thing that's changed, though, is, you know, Putin's relationship with Yanukovych. They've always hated each other, but up till now, they could stomach each other and, you know, sort of hold their noses and hold hands and, you know, walk down the path. It appears now that the signals coming from the Kremlin are that they're ready to cut him loose. And mostly, I think it's because they see him as ineffective, that, you know, even given the bailout, this $15 billion from the Russians and forgiveness of some of the debt and discounted gas prices and Russia's kind of trying at least to fend off Western intervention ostensibly on behalf of the authorities in Ukraine, Yanukovych still is so incompetent that he's unable to put out this fire without making it worse in the process. And that's, you know, that would be why you have talk now coming from the Kremlin that he's like Ceausescu. He's going to go and, you know, it's just as well.
But you were saying earlier, Matthew Rzhensky, that shuffling the deck, at the end of the day, you end up disappointed. That particularly was the case with the so-called democratic leader who was poisoned by the, at least assumption is by the Russians.
Yushchenko.
Yeah. And then now he's living in a government residence, apparently, on the take from Yanukovych, or at least.
Sure.
I mean, it's disgraceful, you know.
Yeah. I mean, everyone, how do I put this delicately, if you put your faith in individual political leaders in this kind of kleptocratic post-Soviet systemic context, you will be disappointed. I think that's why we really need to focus not on, you know, a handful of opposition politicians who will be the saviors of Ukraine, or even a few thousand demonstrators who are willing to make very dramatic sacrifices for noble reasons, but on the real mass of Ukrainians. I'd love to see, these are not silver bullets, but I'd love to see more investment in exchange programs that bring Ukrainians to Europe so that they see what they're missing and they see what's possible and they see kind of real liberal democracy in action, warts and all. They understand how business can get done without bribery. And then I'd love to see some real grit and willingness to sacrifice on the part of tens of millions of people in non-melodramatic ways over a sustained period of time. All of that stuff is time-consuming and complicated, and heretofore, Ukrainians haven't really been willing to do it.
But, you know, this is not North Korea in the sense that North Koreans eventually get South Korean soap operas and that sort of unhinges them. I mean, they're right next door to Europe. They must know about the quality of life in the West.
Some of them do. Many of them. I'd say a couple million people who have visited at least Poland and maybe farther afield, but it's a country of 46 million people.
Right.
You have an older generation that has never left the borders of the old Soviet Union.
Right.
I think you have people who are deeply cynical because all they've seen in their daily lives is one after another local, regional, or national government that exists not to serve the people but to steal from them. And why should they assume that there's something magically different, by bringing this thing called democracy or this thing called rule of law? Laws exist to be exploited and dodged. That's the old Soviet tradition.
So what about Yulia Tymoshenko, the opposition leader that's jailed? Would she be in the category of a potential disappointment?
I think she's already been a disappointment. Remember,
right.
She was prime minister.
And they just fought amongst themselves. That's all they did, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. She enriched herself and her immediate allies. I mean, one of her closest allies, Pavlo Lazarenko, ended up in prison in the United States for a decade for money laundering. Mm-hmm. And whose money was he laundering, right?
Right.
I mean, you can look up the record of that trial. But, bottom line is Tymoshenko, remains in prison. She has not been at the centerpiece of this movement at all. Her former deputy, Yatsenyuk, is to a greater extent, but he has very little interest, frankly, in seeing her come back because that will eclipse his place. And, you know, the statements that she's issued, I'm not terribly encouraged by them because she says things like, keep fighting, don't give up. If you don't get rid of Yanukovych, all is lost. You know, with no mention whatsoever of use peaceful means, let's seek compromise, let's end the violence. You know, that scares me.
So why is the EU then making her release a condition if she's so corrupt?
Well, I don't know that condition is anymore at the center of the EU's demands. That was the case back in November when they thought that Ukraine would sign the association agreement. And even then, frankly, at the last minute, it looked like the EU would be prepared to back down on that if Ukraine would just sign.
Well, just in closing, Matthew Rodzianski, with government snipers now picking off demonstrators and the real possibility you've got police either defecting to the opposition or their police stations in the West have been raided, some troops have turned over. The military, I think, doesn't want to get involved, and that's probably why the general got fired. But do you think that there is any way to stop the escalation towards this becoming a shooting match?
I think the only good way, the only right way to proceed is going to be through the process that we already know, which is you have to find a Band-Aid to stop the bleeding right away. You have to call a truce in it, and somehow both sides have got to have enough discipline to recognize that they can't negotiate in good faith if they're going to break the terms of the truce. So that's the most immediately urgent thing. And then you've got to persuade, and this can involve pressure from the outside, including the United States. You've got to persuade the opposition that they have to be amenable to compromise, that they are not going to get everything that they want, and they are not going to disenfranchise, you know, millions of Ukrainians who still support Yanukovych. And then you've got to obviously convince the regime that they have something to lose. that, in fact, this is not an end game where if they compromise with the opposition, they're going to be Timoshenko'd. They're going to get thrown into prison, and that's the end for them, because then they'll just fight until the very end.
Well, Matthew Rodzinski, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Matthew Rodzinski, who is the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, an expert on U.S. relations with the states of the former Soviet Union, especially Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova. He has advised governments, intergovernmental organizations on conflict resolution and efforts to enhance shared security throughout the Euro-Atlantic and Eurasian regions. Previously, he was deputy director of the Russian and Eurasian program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he founded Carnegie's Ukraine program. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the ousting of the head of Nigeria's central bank, who blew the whistle on a missing $20 billion in oil revenues.